couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies, Ready Player One, Tyler Perry's Acrimony, which is not just a description of his career, it's actually his new movie out, and God's Not Dead, A Light in the Darkness. There'll also be some news, the trailer park, box office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Star Wars The Last Jedi, plus an interview with Ready Player One author Ernest Klein. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Aside from, like, porn star and presidential stories, this week has been kind of slow for entertainment news, and then one of the big stories, which is just so bizarre, is that the Sharknado series is coming to an end, people. Can't we do something about this? Can't we engage Congress? Forget discussions of gun control and taxes and immigration and healthcare. Can't we save the Sharknado franchise? We got the sixth movie is going to end it all. Is that allowed? I have a love-hate relationship with the Sharknado films, mainly because I do love the fact that they're unabashedly stupid. And they're sort of like what the modern trauma movies were back in the 70s and 80s, really. Mostly the 80s was when trauma really blew up, you know, sort of post-Toxic Avenger. The trauma movies never took themselves seriously. They were a wink and a nod at the audience. I mean, their very, very early stuff was just poorly executed garbage, but then they started to become self-aware, and the trauma movies were not necessarily fun to watch because they were too in on the joke. And that's kind of been my problem with Sharknado. I mean, there was this whole run of goofy monster movies on direct-to-cable type show, you know, and it was always Sci-Fi Channel. The Asylum did a whole bunch of them. When they first started out, they were just monster movies, and they, you know, they're the equivalent of the Giant Claw from the 50s. Well, then they became self-aware, and Sharknado became a thing. And as fun as Sharknado is, it then outgrew its own joke. And while the couple movies were fun, it just, it's too in on the joke. And here's the thing. I'm a big proponent of bad movies. I love bad movies, and I love watching terrible movies. But to me, a great terrible movie is a movie that was made honestly to be good and fails miserably at it. Like The Room. We talked about The Room back in December when The Disaster Artist was out. The Room is an honest attempt at making art, and it fails miserably. But it's that honesty bringing it to the screen that makes it entertaining. And I know that that's, oh God, what's the German word for the Schnarfenzufelflein? The whole thing where you take pleasure in somebody else's pain. There's a cheesiness that's fun, but there needs to be an honesty to it. You know, you go back to some of these movies from the 70s and the 80s that were just thrown out there. And it's even, it could even be something relatively mainstream like Code of Silence or Invasion USA, some Chuck Norris movie, or Cobra with Sylvester Stallone. They were deadly serious to these movies, and they're just goofy and fun to watch now. And that's what I love. I remember I was just talking to my father recently about a movie called Slithus, or Spawn of Slithus. So you can find it on Amazon Prime. And it is a terrible monster movie. It was made in the time where everyone, it was post-Jaws, so everybody wanted to make a movie about sea monsters. And this one was about one of those very typical stories, especially you saw these in the 70s, where the environment is coming back to attack, and there's this sort of fish-like Gillman-type creature coming out in Venice, California, and eating dogs and cats, and then graduating to people. And Slithus is a terrible movie, but boy, is it fun to watch. Same thing with, like, Blood Beach. You know, with Paulie from the Rocky movies. I mean, these are fun. Sharknado, I don't think quite makes it. Sharknado is the kind of movie that I think once you remove it from its current pop culture appearance, it just sort of feels odd. Maybe that's going to, once you bury that in the sand for 10,000 years, it'll be better. And ultimately, I also don't like just bad movies that are just poorly done. There needs to be something special about it. That's the problem with Birdemic. Birdemic's just a terrible movie. I will say, it is Easter weekend. Happy Holy Week to everybody. And a lot of people like to watch movies based on what's actually happening on the calendar. You know, like I always like to watch Leprechaun on St. Patrick's Day because I'm a good Irish boy. But if you want to get into the Holy Spirit, you can watch movies like Passion of the Christ or Risen or The Greatest Story Ever Told for those sort of historical films, King of Kings. Those are good ones to check out. There's also current releases out, like I Can Only Imagine is still doing well. Paul the Apostle of Christ is out there right now. It's expanding into theaters this week. And then, of course, God's Not Dead 3, A Light in the Darkness. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But for me, I like watching off-kilter stuff. Stuff that are maybe more secular because it's just a little goofier and fun, like Peter Rabbit or Hop. I wasn't a big fan of either of those, but, you know, they're Easter Bunny kind of movies. I mean, Peter Rabbit's not an Easter Bunny. But I also like to watch Night of the Lepus every year because it's about giant killer rabbits attacking an Arizona town, and it's up to Janet Leigh and DeForest Kelly to save the day. And, of course, Easter falls on April Fool's Day, so why not watch April Fool's Day as well? Do a double feature of goofy horror movies. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Darkest Minds, another young adult best-selling book that's being adapted to the big screen, coming out on August 3rd.
Soon, there wouldn't be any kids anywhere. The government wasn't afraid of what happened to the ones that didn't make it. They were afraid of us. Because the ones that survived changed.
Ruby, you are very rare. Among the most powerful.
We know our time is near.
We're going to a place where kids can live together on the outside.
This looks like more of the same. This looks like that, what was that, that Fifth Wave movie with Chloe Moretz. That's what it feels like, a lot more than, say, Hunger Games, which I think was a breakout hit. And Twilight to a degree. And Divergent, maybe that first movie, but I think that was playing more off the popularity of the Hunger Games. This feels more like all the ones that don't succeed because it is so weirdly focusing on the teenagers for really no apparent reason, at least in the trailer. It could be okay, but it feels a lot like The Fifth Wave, which kind of stunk. So we'll see. I mean, it is an August movie. It might not be very good. And the next one I want to talk about is The House with a Clock in Its Walls, which opens on September 21st, which happens to be Stephen King's birthday, by the way.
The house is a very old place.
There's a clock in the walls.
Do you hear them ticking? Ticking, ticking, ticking.
We don't know what it does, except something horrible.
So, you've told Lewis everything?
Well, not everything.
The most intriguing thing about this movie, and especially if you listen to the trailer, is that it's directed by Eli Roth. And I have to admit, it's probably the first Eli Roth movie trailer I've seen that has really made me interested in the film. And mainly because it's not your typical thing you get from Eli Roth. Usually Eli Roth is very edgy, pushing the boundaries of gore and good taste. Movies like Hostel or Green Inferno, which was about cannibalism. This kind of reminds me of those old Disney movies from the 80s. Remember when Disney was trying to be a little more PG and they didn't want to just be known for cartoons. So they did movies like The Watcher in the Woods and Something Wicked This Way Comes, which was a pretty terrifying movie if you were a little kid. And that's what this reminds me of. Also kind of feels a bit like that Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children that came out last year. That was a Tim Burton movie. But wouldn't it be amazing if this ends up being one of Eli Roth's best pieces he does? Because Eli Roth so plays in that gore-filled sandbox that there's nothing more for him to do, and he's not very nuanced. So, you know, maybe he's got a great cast. You know, Cate Blanchett and Jack Black actually has kind of had a bit of a resurgence in his career. Wouldn't it be amazing if this ended up being one of his better movies because he had to have some restraint and has a good cast? It's great to have Cate Blanchett on your team if you're going to make a movie. And with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking a little bit about Tyler Perry's Acrimony and God's Not Dead, A Light in the Darkness. Welcome back. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews or previews. I think I'm going to start this segment each week as the segment of movies that they don't show people because they're terrified of reviewers. I went off quite a bit last week about why it's stupid for studios to not screen their movies. I mean, they're going to get reviewed anyways. And enough people know, I tell everybody I can see that if they don't screen a movie, it's not a good idea. I mean, if they don't screen a movie, it's probably got a good reason for it. And that's because they don't want the word to get out. Now, in this particular one, you have two movies that do kind of fit into those categories of the audience that you know what you're going to get. The first one is Tyler Perry's Acrimony. A woman, fed up with her devious husband, finally finds the way to fight back.
He was beautiful. Gotta give him that. I was everything he needed me to be. I was strong when he needed me to be. I played weak. 18 years seemed to pass like days. You lie and you cheat. I'm Diana, Robert's fiance.
Like I said, all I know about this movie is what's in the trailer because they didn't screen it for anybody. Maybe in like New York and LA, they got small screenings, but they did not do this regionally. I don't think they've screened a Tyler Perry movie. Oh, heavens. I mean, if you talk about like an actual Tyler Perry directed movie, did he do that Alex Cross film? Or did he just star in it? I think the last actual honest to God screening I went to of a Tyler Perry movie was the first Why Did I Get Married, which was like 10 years ago. And I remember they screened the first Diary of a Mad Black Woman. And I know they screened like maybe the second Madea movie, but they just don't screen those anymore at all. And they don't screen any Tyler Perry movies because they have a built-in audience. And when it comes to the Madea movies, you know exactly what you're going to get, which is garbage. But at least, you know, when you're making Boo 3, a third Madea Halloween this year, that you pretty much know you're getting the mix of preachy gospel play and Tyler Perry thinking he's funnier than he really is, doing riffs with himself because he plays all the characters. But he also tries to do some very serious stuff. And he did that movie, Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor. I think that might be the last sort of serious Tyler Perry movie I saw, which was something like 4 or 5 years ago that I checked out. And he doesn't have a whole lot of nuance. Tyler Perry is not a subtle man when it comes to directing. So when he makes a movie like this, it's very steeped and heavy and just dripping in negative emotion. And I know his stuff is supposed to ultimately be uplifting. It ultimately turns into these gospel plays where it has this sort of moralistic element that sometimes goes too far, like with the Marriage Counselor movie, where it was basically the woman gets punished for cheating on her husband, so she gets AIDS, but the men don't get punished. You know, there was a lot of sort of weird gender politics that goes into his movies that was prevalent in that. The fact that Taraji P. Henson's in this movie is probably the best thing it's got going for it. But, you know, my problem with Tyler Perry movies is just such a depressing outlook on life. And is that a cultural thing? Maybe. I don't know. I don't live in African-American culture. I mean, I'm just a white guy from the suburbs. And apparently this does connect with his audience, which tends to be the focus being African-American Christian women. You know, maybe it connects with that audience. I'm not part of that audience. So maybe this will be exactly what that audience wants. But overall, it has no interest to me just because it just seems like such a depressing movie from concept stage. So it has to suck because it didn't get screened.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about God's Not Dead, A Light in the Darkness. After his church burns down, a pastor teams up with an atheist lawyer to save his congregation.
St. James Church has become a beacon of violence and controversy. And it has no place on Hadley University campus.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
It's kind of weird. Somebody burns your church down, but you're okay.
How do we actually know that our values are any more valid than anyone else's?
I don't understand, Lord. Seems like you're the one much is being asked of this time.
The God's Not Dead movies, the first one, the Kevin Sorbo movie, was one of the first ones that kind of made people say, oh, hey, you know, these contemporary Christian movies with a message, can do well in release in the big theaters. And it helps that nowadays you don't actually have to strike, you know, 500 prints on film and spend the money for that and ship those around. You can send stuff around on hard drive, which is a lot cheaper and easier to do. And sometimes you can just download the movies. That's how the digital cinemas work. So it makes it easier and more accessible to smaller distribution companies to send their movie out. And that certainly helps, you know, sort of like these smaller films that are trying to get some traction in a bigger marketplace. The first God's Not Dead did well. It was sort of like, I think the first ones that really hit were like Fireproof and Courageous, which were those Kirk Cameron movies. But then, you know, of course, God's Not Dead was one of them. And I said the ones that tended to do best at that time were the definitive declarations of faith. God's Not Dead. Heaven is for real. Those kind of movies. Whereas a movie like Mom's Night Out, which was certainly a Christian themed film, didn't get as much play because Mom's Night Out doesn't sound like a Christian-themed film. God's Not Dead certainly does. And look, I'm not a big fan of these movies, in particular the God's Not Dead movies. I think they're incredibly heavy-handed. It starts with a straw man argument, because the whole point was Kevin Sorbo's character. And the first one was saying, you have to prove in my philosophy class that God is dead. You can't do that. I mean, it's a ludicrous assignment to begin with, because you can't prove something doesn't exist that some people thought exist. I mean, it's an improvable concept. Either way, dead or alive, it's a question of faith. And it also has some really weird anti-Muslim stuff in these movies, which is kind of like disturbing, especially if you want to, you know, I mean, this is the land of religious freedom, isn't it? And the second movie was not very good. The first one wasn't terribly good. I mean, it did well because it preached to the choir. But the second one didn't do as well. I think it did about half as well as the first one. Now, this one I don't think has Kevin Sorbo in it at all. It's got like John Corbett, who's shown up in a couple of these movies. He's still trying to make a living. But I don't get a real sense of story on this one. Part of the thing is the first God's Not Dead. I mean, it was seriously like, oh, these kids against the atheistic professor and, you know, they're butting heads, faith versus logic kind of thing. Whereas this one, it seems more like a Hallmark play. You know, it seems, I think there is something buried in there. And again, I'm going from the trailer because they didn't screen this, but there seems to be something buried in there where, you know, he's got an atheist lawyer and I'm sure he brings him into faith in some way. But it seems a little half-baked, at least from the concept stage. And it doesn't feel like it's following the other two movies. So I don't know how well it's going to do. Plus, you're looking at a lot of competition from I Can Only Imagine, which, of course, is a juggernaut in terms of contemporary Christian cinema. So you are deluding the audience. And, I mean, right now it's the end of Holy Week. You got Easter weekend. People are coming out to see movies. But, you know, even when they re-released Passion of the Christ on Easter the following year after it did extremely well, it still kind of fizzled in the marketplace. Because most people are spending Easter at church or with friends or at dinner or with their kids, they're not going to a movie. I don't think Easter is as big of a movie-going day as, say, like Christmas is. I still have to say that God's Not Dead, A Light in the Darkness, must suck because they didn't screen it. Preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Ready Player One and interview the writer of the book, Ernest Cline. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's launch right into the full movie reviews with the only one that they screened this week, and that is Ready Player One. 30 years in the future, people escape the depression of life in a virtual reality world. Now, one player begins to discover the Easter eggs hidden by the game's creator to lead him to control the platform forever.
The Oasis was the brainchild of James Halliday.
Hello. If you're watching this, I'm dead. I created a hidden object, an Easter egg. The first person to find the egg will inherit $500 billion and total control of the Oasis itself.
Who is this Parzival, and how the hell is he winning?
Find him. This isn't just a game.
I grew up in the 80s, and I'm like, I think, 6 months older than Ernest Cline, who wrote this book. And he's from Ashland, Ohio, which is about an hour or so north of Columbus, between Columbus and Cleveland. And, you know, I mean, I could have gone and hung out with him. I mean, literally, we could have been at the same movie theater at some point if he came down to Columbus to see a movie. I mean, I constantly watched films in the 90s and 80s. And, I mean, so I am predisposed to like this. And it's really just sort of a celebration of... And I'm reticent to say geek culture because it's culture. I mean, everyone likes Star Wars. Everyone liked Back to the Future. You can't sit there and marginalize Back to the Future and say that, oh, only geeks like that one. It was a huge hit. Same thing with, you know, reference at one point, they do a lot of references to The Shining. More than just horror movie fans saw The Shining. The Shining was a huge movie. It's a big part of culture. So there's so much in this movie that goes beyond just sort of like geek culture and gaming culture. Yeah, you have something like Iron Giant, which didn't do terribly well. So it kind of has more of a, you know, a smaller following, but it certainly has a lot of love out there. But you can't throw out, you know, references to Freddy Krueger or the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and say, well, that's just nerds who like that stuff. So this movie is essential Spielberg. He's been doing a lot of movies lately. Spielberg has been doing like stuff like The Post, and he did Lincoln, and he's been doing a lot of more serious stuff. And I think his last sort of grand adventure kind of movie was Tintin. This is him kind of returning to form. And as much as I love The Post and I loved Lincoln and I love his serious movies, it's fun to just watch the good old excitement again. This is going back to Amberlin Entertainment. This is going back to the kind of stuff that maybe you didn't even direct, stuff like Back to the Future. Zemeckis directed that. But, you know, Jurassic Park, you had all this stuff in the 80s and 90s that really just sort of like helped define a lot of people's childhoods. And, you know, as much as I love Star Wars, there was a lot of other stuff that Spielberg had his hands in. Like I said, you know, kind of from 1982 when he did E.T. all the way through Jurassic Park in 1993. I mean, he kind of ruled the name on that. And even though not every movie that he did at that time was a big hit or that he produced at that time was a big hit, it was a big deal just to see some of these on the big screen. I remember seeing Back to the Future in the theaters initially when it came out, and it was just fun. And that's what this movie is. It's high energy. It's got great action. It's got beautiful special effects. It's got a good cast to it. Ty Sheridan's good. Olivia Cooke's great in the movie. And it has so many references to stuff that even some people don't get. You know, like there's references to Buckaroo Banzai that a lot of people don't understand because Buckaroo Banzai is a very fringe piece of 80s cinema. But I mean, that's also something big for Ernest Cline, who wrote this because he wrote a spec script for Buckaroo Banzai Against the World Crime League. So there's a little bit of history woven in there. Spielberg was a perfect guy to do this because he gets the wonder, he gets the fascination. And you know, I mean, there's going to be people out there that are going to be upset because there's changes made to it, as Spielberg always does in his books. And I'm going to talk a little bit more with Ernest Cline about that in a little bit. But it's just a fun movie. It's exciting. It kind of has that sense of wonder. I remember originally Christopher Nolan was rumored to be trying to put this to the screen. I think that would have been a disaster. That guy doesn't have the heart and soul that Spielberg does. This is just a fun movie. I don't want to say too much about it in terms of details because it's just better to watch it all unfold. So in the end, I'm going to have to say that Ready Player One totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and I've got a little treat here. We've got an interview with Ernest Cline, who, of course, wrote Ready Player One and, of course, worked on the script and the movie itself. Straight from Columbus, Ohio. I'm actually in Columbus.
Oh, right on. Yeah, I was just there a few weeks ago for a book signing up in Westerville.
Yeah, you're from Ashland, home of Grandpa's Cheese Barn, right?
Grandpa's Cheese Barn and Village. Yeah, that's out the rest stop out by the highway.
That's right. I pass by it all the time. I've been there a couple times. My wife's from Mansfield.
Oh, yeah. Mansfield's where we used to have to go for first-run movies because Ashland Square Cinema only had, like, old stuff.
Oh, okay.
We're always going over to Mansfield to see new movies and go to Aladdin's Castle at the Richland Mall.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I've been to the Richland Mall. Yeah, yeah. From your perspective, getting Steven Spielberg to direct the movie, which is so steeped in 80s nostalgia, and having somebody who was had a hand, a very strong hand, in developing all that nostalgia that we as a generation grew up with.
Yeah, the most perfect bit of synchronicity that's ever happened in my life. I'm still shocked. You know, it's been 3 years, you know, since he signed on to do this movie, and I've gotten to go through pre-production working with him, and then, you know, being on set and then going through post-production. And now we're showing the movie and promoting it. And I still, you know, it's been 3 years. I still haven't wrapped my head around it. Still seems like this surreal, wonderful experience. And, you know, just what should happen to every writer. Like I feel like I'm this strange example of like what happens if you just unabashedly celebrate the things that you love. That's what I did with Ready Player One. It was like building a bonfire or a statue, an idol to all the different things that I love and how much I love them. And, you know, and by doing that, I've somehow managed to draw the very people who helped inspire me to write the story and inspired me to become a storyteller and a filmmaker, like those very people I ended up being drawn to me to help me make this movie. You know, they say, be bold and powerful forces will come to your aid. That's what's happened to me.
One of the things that Spielberg's always done in his career is he's done some iconic movies, in particular like Jurassic Park and Jaws, and he had the development with the author in both of those for his films. But his films had some significant changes based on the book, even though Benchley worked on the script for Jaws and Crichton worked on the script for Jurassic Park. Did you see something similar with Ready Player One as that was being developed?
Yes, you know, I feel like I got to be involved even more directly or just as directly. You know, I think Michael Crichton had written his drafts prior to Steven coming on board, and then he developed it later. But, you know, from the moment that Steven came on board, he started to include me as a collaborator. And he and Zach Penn and I kind of worked through every change from the book, and Steven had us put back in a lot of stuff that had gotten excised from the book over the development process. And we figured out how to rework sequences from the book so that they could go back into the story if we, you know, made them more cinematic. I knew that there were going to have to be changes made from the novel because the whole time I was writing it, I never thought it would be a movie. You know, I purposefully wrote it thinking that it was unfilmable because of all the different rights, you know, that would have to be acquired, that I wanted to pay tribute to pop culture and mash up all of pop culture together in this virtual world. And I didn't think there was any way that could have, you know, anyone could execute that. You know, the one example that I would always use, you know, when people ask about a film adaptation of Ready Player One was Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I said, oh, well, maybe something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit happened. And Steven Spielberg is the one who made that happen. He called all the different studios and asked them, he said, you know, we're doing a tribute to the whole history of animation. Will you let us use your property? And they all said yes, because they wanted to be involved in a Amblin movie. And that's what happened with Ready Player One. You know, pretty much everyone we asked was thrilled to have their IP featured in a Steven Spielberg movie. So I really think that, you know, if this script had found its way to any other filmmaker, still might have gotten made into a movie, but not one that resembles my book as much as it does. Because the whole, you know, bare bones of the story, you know, the way that it plays out and the characters, it's all there. Just, you know, the way that happens in a lot of film adaptations, you know, Harry Potter, Tolkien, regardless of the source material or how revered it is, you have to, things that will work in a book won't work in a movie all the time. And so you have to change them to make them more cinematic. So I was at home with that process, and I was just thrilled in how much of the little details of my book still made it into the movie, like stuff even that had never been in any draft of the script still made it into the movie because all the different departments had marching orders to consult the book from Steven. So like when you meet Lena Waithe's character H in the real world for the first time, she's wearing exactly what she's wearing in the book when Waithe first meets her, you know, and that's because the costume designer picked up on that from the novel. Nice. And put it in the movie. And there was stuff like that all around. Everywhere I would look, I would see little details taken from my book and put directly in the movie. So, you know, having seen the movie with an audience now, I wouldn't change anything or second guess any of the decisions that we made.
We need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be continuing the interview with Ernest Cline and talking about the box office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Star Wars The Last Jedi. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the interview with Ernest Cline, author of Ready Player One. And did you have a bean count of how many pop culture references you had in the book and how many are in the movie? Because, I mean, it's overwhelming trying to keep track of everything.
No, it is. I don't think that even Zach, Steven, or I know all of the references that are hidden in there. Steven said the other night at South by Southwest that when he was doing his final approval of the last special effects shots, he spotted a gremlin that somebody at ILM had snuck in to one shot without even telling him, you know. And Adam Stockhausen, our production designer, who's amazing, you know, and Zach and I, we were often doing that, you know, kind of sneaking things in, see if we could get them past Steven, because he was, you know, very against referencing himself, you know, which, yeah. You know, Zach was that way too. You know, I snuck a reference to Zach's first movie, Last Action Hero, into the story. You know, he wouldn't have wanted to do it himself, but I did it, you know, kind of behind his back because I love that movie and because it helped inspire, you know, the Flixxinks and the idea of going into another movie in my book. And so I wanted to pay tribute to it in Ready Player One. But like, you know, no one really wants to toot their own horn, but I'm happy to toot Steven's horn and Zach's horn because I think they're both really talented guys who helped, you know, inspire me. So we kind of had to, we had to convince Steven or, you know, be sneaky and to get him to reference his own stuff. But he agreed, you know, for some stuff like the T-Rex and the DeLorean.
When the trailer hit, there was this weird backlash because it has to happen on the internet, I guess. But you see this against stuff like, you know, the Big Bang Theory or even Marvel movies now. What do you say to people who are sort of enraged that these sort of properties appropriate nerd culture? Do you think that that's something that happens or do you think it's not anything to worry about?
Well, you know, I don't think it's anything to really worry about. It's part of the pylon mob mentality nature of social media is, you know, people get a dopamine rush from, you know, hating on something and then forming a mob with other people to hate on it. And it doesn't matter what it is, but there is definitely something about Ready Player One, both as the novel and now the film that people are seeing promoted, that, you know, if you're a bitter, joyless cynic, you get triggered by how much joy people derive from stuff. Like if you see other people just freaking out and deriving joy from something that brings you no joy at all, like that really pisses some people off. And then they, you know, want to tell you why you shouldn't be deriving joy from it. Here's a whole list of reasons you shouldn't be feeling good about any of the stuff you know, love so much. That is the whole antithesis of Ready Player One, you know, and it's the antithesis of Steven Spielberg, I found, you know, like I am a testament to what happens when you unabashedly celebrate the things that you love and you don't care, you know, whether other people love them or not. You know, like writing Ready Player One, I feel like is like me building this giant, you know, bonfire or idol, you know, or shrine to all these different things that I love about pop culture and, you know, and saying, you know, I love this stuff. Don't you love it too? And, you know, how much do you love it? And some people, you know, that's offensive to them. But I mean, like, those are the kind of people that you wouldn't want to please, you know, or ever, you know, if you, after, you know, that South by Southwest screening, you know, like, which was just amazing. And like, I've been to going South by Southwest for 20 years and I've never seen a reaction like that. Just so many people filled with so much joy and having such a good time, you know, and if you can walk out of that and be surrounded by that and still, you know, be pissed off, then, you know, this is never a story that was going to appeal to you anyhow, because it's a story about people who love the things that they love and love people who love things, you know. And if you're the kind of person who hates things, then maybe you should stay at home. But if you want to see a celebration of your childhood and also just an amazing, fun action-adventure story and a beautifully realized vision of the future and special effects sequences and set pieces, like, you've seen the movie, right?
Oh, yeah. I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like it's such embodies so much love and passion and joy. And, you know, seeing Steven Spielberg geek out, you know, and worship his heroes, too, like, it's unique. There's never been a movie like it. So any act of pure joy and enthusiasm is almost a revolutionary act. There's so much, you know, negativity and cynicism. You know, you come out and, you know, are filled with love and positivity, that's going to fly in the face of a lot of people's worldview. But I'm happy to do that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Thank you, Ernest Cline, for coming on the show to talk with us about Ready Player One. Now let's take a look at the box office. Finally, it happened. Something knocked Black Panther off of its throne. That's not a massive feat because it's a 6 week of release, and Black Panther had scooted down after making $630 million. It had made $17 million over the weekend, which is not bad in its 6 week of release. But Pacific Rim Uprising did a little bit better than expectations and made $28 million, which is good. I mean, a lot of people don't let, like, Deadline, which somehow went on a hit run against Pacific Rim and all these other movies, just hating on them. It's not anything against the $150 million budget, but then again, Pacific Rim Uprising was not made for America. People got to understand that. It's the same reason why they're making a Warcraft sequel and not even releasing it in America. The only reason we got a sequel was because it was made for the Asian market, because these movies do well in Asia. There's a huge history of kaiju movies from Asia. Don't believe anything otherwise. They're releasing it in America almost as a courtesy. Case in point, it made four times as much over its first week in international markets than it did in America, and that is how this movie's going to run. Sherlock Gnomes underperformed with under 11 million. Paul the Apostle Christ came in like eighth with like about five. And then Midnight Sun barely made it into the top 10 with 4 million. And Unsane, unfortunately, which is a better movie, came in with a less than 4 million. And of course, I think Ready Player One is going to be poised to win this week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This little independent film that came out, it's now available on DVD and Blu-ray, and of course it's been available on demand for a couple weeks, and that is Star Wars The Last Jedi. As Rey struggles to connect with a disenchanted Luke Skywalker, General Leia Organa tries to lead the last shreds of their resistance from being utterly destroyed by the First Order.
Something inside me has always been there. But now it's awake. And I need help.
I've seen this raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
When I saw this movie in December, the rep asked me, as I'm walking out, she said, what would you think? And I was like, I'm kind of conflicted. I don't quite know yet. I need to see it again. Now, unlike The Force Awakens, which I loved unabashedly from the moment I saw it, The Last Jedi, I was unsettled a little bit about it, partly because it's an incomplete story. It's a bridge. Second of all, I'm not a huge fan of Rian Johnson. I know there are people that are crazy Rian Johnson fans. Not a huge fan of Rian Johnson. And I think there's a little bit too much of his dour and heaviness in the film, but you always get a darker movie in the sequel. So we'll see what happens when J.J. Abrams takes over the last movie. But I finally got a chance to rewatch this, and rewatching it on Blu-ray with the family in the comfort of my own home, I realized I like the movie. I did enjoy the film, but there's little things that I got hung up on. Yeah, Leia doing the little Superman thing. It's goofy. I think it's poorly executed. I don't have a problem with it existing in Star Wars, but it's kind of like the whole Martha moment in Batman versus Superman. It was a okay idea, just not terribly well executed. But I'm not going to hold that against the movie. I do have a problem with the fact that it's like we're wiping everybody out in this movie, which I'm not a big fan of that. And I know part of this is them saying, okay, we're finishing the Skywalker saga. Nostalgia aside, it's nice to have the Millennium Falcon. It's nice to have Chewbacca. But we need to get rid of some of these characters that everybody's clinging to and do our own new stuff. I get that. I just think it's a little overly punishing. The big sticking point I have is Laura Dern. I did not like her in this movie. I thought her character was awful, and no, it's not because she's a woman. I'm not a sexist because I'm like, Star Wars is for boys. No, I don't have a problem with generals that are women. I have a problem with Laura Dern's character because she doesn't explain what she's doing to her own team. She's just like, I have an idea and you follow my orders. You don't question me and, you know, life and death for everybody, but she doesn't share with anybody what's going on. And ends up putting in motion the problems that end up causing more problems. You know, it's poor writing at that moment where Laura Dern's character is being too secretive to her inner circle almost, you know, to her most trusted people in the resistance. Plus, there's sort of like kind of how she gets out of this whole thing. It's neat cinematically, but I can't believe no one's ever tried this before. Anyways, I still think the movie's good and it's fun. And I'm excited to see the next one. It's not as good as The Force Awakens, but, you know, it also looks great on Blu-ray. And it has, you know, plenty of features. You know, it's got a feature-length commentary. It's got a bunch of deleted scenes and some behind-the-scenes videos and scene breakdowns. So, yeah, it's certainly worth getting to complete your Star Wars collection that's going to continue to grow this year and beyond. So, ultimately, I'm going to say Star Wars The Last Jedi rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other DVD and Blu-ray releases include Mr. Robot Season 3, The Outer Limits Season 1, and Behind the Mask, The Rise and Fall of Leslie Vernon. That's it for the show. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Blockers, Chappaquiddick, The Miracle Season, and A Quiet Place. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.